Welcome to On Air with Clean Air Council, where we delve into a broad array of topics related to the environment and public health. I'm your host, Katie Edwards. For those of you not familiar with us, Clean Air Council is a member-supported, nonprofit environmental organization dedicated to protecting everyone's right to a healthy environment. The council is headquartered in Philadelphia and works through public education, community advocacy, and government oversight to ensure enforcement of environmental laws. For more information, please visit cleanair.org. Today we have with us Stiv Wilson. Stiv is an award-winning activist and an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. After completing 35,000 nautical miles sailing the world to study marine plastic pollution, Stiv co-authored the first ever global estimate of the abundance of plastics in all major five oceans in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS-1. Stiv went on to pass state-level policy as well as the Plastic-Free Waters Act, the first plastics-focused national policy, which was signed into law by President Obama in 2015. He has produced The Story of Plastic, which has won several awards, including an Emmy. Stiv, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Happy to be here. Thanks so much, Katie.
Absolutely. We're really excited to talk today about the issue of plastics and pollution and how it's fueling the climate crisis. Can we start off by talking a little about your film, The Story of Plastic? What factors led you to making this documentary?
A lot of my work in the beginning of my career was sort of focused on understanding how much plastic is in the environment and really coming to this issue through the lens of ocean conservation and understanding plastics getting into watersheds and ultimately into the ocean. And what happens is that sort of begets the question, where is it coming from? And that starts a rabbit hole investigation of going farther and farther upstream and ultimately getting to where plastics are produced at the point of extraction and refining of fossil fuels. So there's a lot of steps in between there. But ultimately, what I recognized in my own journey was there were people working at different parts of the system, and the left hand wasn't necessarily talking to the right hand. You know, people working at, you know, the point of extraction, but not talking to people working on waste management, or, you know, rich countries were exporting their plastics to poor countries, and those countries weren't talking. There weren't any treaties in place to sort of guard how those materials flowed across borders and what kind of human rights issues that would speak to. And as I was investigating this with other colleagues, I recognized that this system is not something that is well understood by the general public, but also even advocates working on the issue, and certainly politicians. And so we set out as a team to make a story that would investigate all parts of those systems in various parts of the world, thereby universalizing this plastic system, which is a globalized system. And the story of plastic specifically came to me as I was in a landfill in Metro Manila in the Philippines, and this place called Smoky Mountain, which is named so because there's organic matter that has been buried there that the heat and decomposing is making it literally smoke. And there are people who live within this landfill, and they mine it for materials that they can sell. These are the poorest of the poor in the sort of waste picker stratification that many developing world countries have. And taking this photo, I had probably like a $5,000 camera at the time, and I was taking a photo of a man who was sleeping in the midday sun with a baby on his chest. We sort of recognized between us a common humanity, but also at the same time recognized a very different walk of life. And I realized that this camera is probably worth more than anything he is ever going to make in his lifetime. And that sort of privilege made me realize what the true cost of this material is, and what people on planet Earth are affected by it and how much it affects them. I felt like the story wasn't really known or being told to a broad public. And that's when I decided, you know, I wanted to make this movie, and I assembled a team, and we set out to do very much that.
Your movie goes into the issue of plastics and the history behind plastics. Can you give us just a quick snapshot of the history of plastic as a material?
The first sort of commercial material, I believe, was like Bakelite, which is like a really hard plastic. Like, I mean, I'm dating myself, but if you think of like the red phone in the movies of yore, which that sort of material is Bakelite, that sort of hard plastic. You know, it became a way to industrialize many technologies at the time. It was a vehicle for World War II. It was a vehicle for insulating wires and making safer electrical systems and grids and that sort of thing. But it really didn't get its big push until the 60s when Life magazine did this series on convenience living or convenience lifestyle. And it was first marketed to women who were homemakers in, you know, in the 60s as a way to sort of free up their life and time and get them, quote unquote, out of the kitchen and, you know, show the ease of being able to throw a party with disposable objects versus having to like wash, you know, these things. So that's where it really started becoming a force in the market as a product that was literally meant to be thrown away. And I think that even that concept, especially just after World War II, where everything was saved, and I'm sure like lots of us have older family members who, you know, have the inherent value of not being wasteful and saving useful products and reusing, you know, coffee tins and this sort of thing. That was sort of blown wide open. Even philosophically, people didn't think of materials as disposable at the time. And that was a revolution that, you know, has now created the nightmare scenario we're living in today with all the plastic waste.
Yeah, that was the Buy More Plastics campaign of the time. Because plastic was kind of revered and looked at as something for convenience and for modernization, when did people start to realize that plastic, and especially plastic waste, is a problem for society?
That's a hard question to answer because I still think there's a lot of people who don't necessarily recognize that that's a problem. But let me sort of couch this in my own origin story because I do think it tracks sort of the popular culture conception of plastic pollution. And I think it was really the discovery of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch by Captain Charles Moore from Algalita Research and Education. He is certainly, to me, the granddaddy of plastic pollution. He had done a sailboat race from the western United States to Hawaii called the Transpac. And he was coming back with the boat because he needed to move the boat back to Long Beach, Southern California. And he took a way that most mariners would never take, which is through what are called the doldrums, places where there's high pressure and no wind. And these would be avoided by sailors. But he decided to cut the time by motoring through. And what he noticed is massive accumulations of plastic in this garbage patch or in these naturally occurring phenomenons called gyres, which are essentially just a whirlpool that, you know, form in all the major oceans. And they orbit clockwise in the northern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. And there's one in every major ocean. And as you get towards the center of these gyres, the plastic concentrates. This, of course, can be affected by storms or whatever. But these images coming out of, like, the middle of the ocean filled with plastic pollution was starting to hit the New York Times. And this is when we as a public started recognizing that this was a problem. You know, what I find really interesting about plastic pollution, plastic is just frozen chemicals. It is the visual representation of climate change. It is fossil fuels in solid form that are nearly indestructible and resilient and accumulate. And I think that sort of captured the imagination because anybody going to a beach, I don't care if, you know, you voted for Biden or voted for Trump, nobody likes plastic on the beach. And that sort of, at first, was a very nonpartisan investigation that universally rich country, poor country, right, left, looked at it and said, this is a bad thing because it is not natural in the environment and it shouldn't be there. And so that's when I think, you know, this started really beginning to take off. And this wasn't until, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And at the time I started working on plastic pollution, I could have told you everybody in the world who was getting paid to work on this stuff. And now that's, you know, thousands and thousands of people. So it has certainly blown up since then.
So I'm glad you touched on plastics and fossil fuels for a moment. Can we take a step back and explain to our listeners the chain of plastics production to disposal and why this is so important when we're talking about the material and how it's made?
You know, 99% of all plastics are made from fossil fuels. And when you drill for fossil fuels, there are a lot of hydrocarbons that are beneath the surface. I say hydrocarbons, I'm just talking about different chemicals. They all have different weights. It all comes out of the ground. Some of them are useful from a commercial application standpoint. Some are not. And so the ones that are not are typically just burned off. And the ones that are collected and separated and used to make various petrochemicals. And that's all the way from fuels to fertilizers to plastics. What industry recognized in a new technology of extraction called hydraulic fracturing, which is fracking, there was a type of hydrocarbon that was coming up called ethane, which is the building blocks for plastics. And that became a very valuable resource to further enhance the bottom line of fossil fuel companies. Like, they don't care what you make out of these ingredients. They just want to make a market happen for each one of them that they can. And that might be for, like, ammonia. That might be for propane. That might be for fuel for your car. And then ethane is extracted to make plastics. And ethane is heated and broken apart to create a chain, which gives plastic its strength. And that is a polymer chain because ethane is a monomer. And when you string them all together, like think of like a pearl necklace, the individual hydrocarbon is really, really strong. That's the pearl. The chain in between is relatively weak, which is the string holding the pearls together. And why that's important is plastics don't actually biodegrade in the environment. They just break apart into smaller and smaller pieces. The actual molecule of plastic will persist indefinitely. So this is what the problem is in the environment precisely. And the problem with waste plastic is there's nowhere for it to really go because it doesn't biodegrade. So we throw it in our garbage can and then it goes and accumulates in a landfill. We throw it in our recycling bin. There's no market for it because there is so much more money in extracting virgin materials and making plastic out of that than there is for recycling it. So we ship it to other countries to try and get rid of it. And that becomes a sea of plastics in a developing world country, some of which we highlighted in our film, The Story of Plastic, which accumulates and accumulates and accumulates and accumulates. And I guess the way to think of the plastic pollution crisis, or the way I like to think of it, is it's a very slow snowstorm that is never ending. And it's constantly accumulating on planet Earth. And the only way to stop that from happening is to not make it in the first place.
Unfortunately, it seems like we're ramping up oil and gas development and building these huge petrochemical facilities. Clean Air Council, we're based in Pennsylvania, so we are no stranger to fracking. And we see the impacts of the large Shell ethane cracker. Can you talk a little bit about these petrochemical facilities? What are their health impacts? What are their environmental impacts? These giant facilities that are making the plastic.
So the Beaver Cracker, ethane cracker in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, is a leviathan. It is massive. The capacity for that thing to turn out plastic, if you were only making plastic bottles, beverage bottles, not just water bottles, I'm talking all beverage bottles, this single plant would have the capacity to meet 15% of the entire world's demand of beverage bottles. That's insane. There's 7.5 billion people on the planet. And this one plant could do it. And think about how much it's going to need to be fed. And the Ohio River Valley, western Pennsylvania, Ohio, parts of West Virginia, parts of Kentucky, they sit on these two really large shale formations that are deep below the ground, the Marcellus and Utica Shale. If you think about to like feed that cracker alone, you're going to have to drill 1,500 to 2,000 fracking wells every 3 to 5 years to keep it fed. Which, you know, when you go to southwestern Pennsylvania, Washington County, Greene County, like you can't throw a rock without hitting a fracking well already. You know, where are we going to drill more? I mean, there's so much drilling that, you know, you're having seismic activity because, you know, the land is not stable under where people are living and farms and watersheds and that sort of thing. So this is the broad connection. As the fossil fuel industry is recognizing that transportation and energy is pivoting to renewables or electric vehicles, they're looking for a long-term growth strategy for fossil fuels. Again, this is an industry that is a hammer, and to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So again, they don't care what they're making out of this. They just want to make something. And they're pivoting to plastics as a long-term growth strategy and some other petrochemicals as well. But this was sort of the hope for revitalization in the Ohio River Valley. The problem is it's a sham. It's a con. And like, I don't care if you're left or right. These promises they're talking about, the economic development, the jobs, like they don't materialize. There's a really great organization called Ohio River Valley Institute, and I encourage your listeners to go check out some of their reports, where all the communities that are taking these big facilities actually go backwards economically. And that's data. That's not sort of partisan politics. That if you literally look at their development, they are losing ground. These jobs don't materialize. And then the human health costs are massive, which we don't even know what they are entirely yet. But in the case of Beaver County, this massive ethane cracker that is there, it is sitting in a river valley. And Pennsylvania is all rolling hills or hollers, as they're called, and valleys. And air sits in those. In the wintertime, you get these inversions. All that chemical pollution that's supposed to be going out of the smokestacks into the air is being trapped in the atmosphere where people live, and they're breathing it. It's colorless. It's odorless. But if you look at places that have had chemical plants for a really long time, such as Cancer Alley, between Baton Rouge and New Orleans in Louisiana, you have towns that the risk of cancer is 150 times the national average. These are people just living and breathing in a community. And this is unfortunately what the legacy of these plants are. I don't think you could pick a worse place to put this particular plant on planet Earth than in an inversion sandwiched between like three population centers, which is where the Shell cracker is in Beaver County. And it's a danger to every living thing that is nearby it.
It's funny because even if the cracker was running up to code and smoothly, we're dealing with all of that pollution. But the Shell cracker, the Beaver cracker, as you call it, has been in violation of its permits so many times, essentially by producing more pollution than they were allowed to produce in a time period. So that's compounding all of these health effects and these environmental impacts. So beyond these impacts, how is petrochemical facilities like these, how are they fueling the climate crisis?
Well, first of all, let's talk about permits real quick. You know, when you want to drive a car, you need to get a permit, which is a driver's license. You need to pass a test, and you have to show that you can operate safely a vehicle, and then you get to drive. You are now permitted by society. In the case of this industry, a permit is a permit to pollute or to release greenhouse gases into the air. So it is an exception to a rule, is what it is. It's not a permit to operate. I mean, there are permits to operate as well you have to meet. But the permits we're talking about are what is allowed to be pushed into the atmosphere. So the problem is it's toxics that come out by the thousands of tons that people are breathing, and that's affecting them. But what also is coming out of these pipes are greenhouse gases that are trapped in the atmosphere that absorb the sun's light and heat the earth. Every single new oil and gas facility, no matter what you're making, is a climate bomb for planet Earth. It really doesn't matter what the end product is. The process itself is reliant on putting pollution into the world indiscriminately and putting greenhouse gases into the world indiscriminately. If these things were profitable without emitting greenhouse gases or pollution, we wouldn't be doing it. But the entire industry is contingent and reliant on polluting and reliant on changing the climate for its very business model to be relevant and work, which is the biggest problem with the industry there is. And it's not fair. Frankly, if you're a business owner in the U.S., you are not subsidized to compete in the marketplace. You are up against anybody else who is trying to sell the same goods and service you are. That's not true of the fossil fuel industry, because we literally pay them thousands and millions and billions of dollars to operate these facilities. And meanwhile, they're making our air less breathable and our land less livable. It's a sham. It's a con.
It is. And the Shell cracker plant has gotten over $1 billion in taxpayer subsidies as they were built and since they've been open.
And think about what we could have invested in instead of that. Then how many jobs are there? Not very many. There's not very many permanent jobs after the construction of that facility.
Just to switch gears for a minute, how do you feel about the media coverage of the plastics crisis?
I think the media in general was really interested in the plastics in the ocean piece. It was because it was so new and novel. It was, frankly, it was the new cause celeb. And it was affecting animals that we all care about, you know, the charismatic macrofauna, the whales, the dolphins, the turtles. It's actually affecting the uncharismatic microfauna a lot more. But, you know, nobody really protests oil and gas to save plankton. But, you know, plankton are taking a huge hit. And I'm a big fan of plankton. Anyways, I think the media has sort of like done a really poor job of demonstrating the system by which these things come into being and the true costs of, you know, the people who bear the brunt, both at the waste side of this issue, you know, the consumer health issues of eating off of plastic, drinking out of plastic, because it does leach chemicals, and certainly the people who live where it's being extracted or refined. And I would say, you know, people driving down the road by these plants have no idea that this is where the coffee cup lid is coming from, and ultimately that people are getting cancer or asthma or various respiratory illnesses. The media is just not linking the convenience lifestyle and the dependence on this superfluous, silly plastic and the true cost to society, especially those living around the front line of where it's being built. So I'm not a big fan of how the media has covered this, and it's why I'm a storyteller in this space. I think the media coverage got better after the story of plastic. I think our team worked very hard and intentionally to frame the narrative in the way we think it needs to be framed. And I saw a pretty wide scale adoption of that narrative, certainly by the advocacy community and much more by the media since.
Right now, we're making more plastic than we can use. Why is that? And where is all this excess plastic going?
So the problem is fossil fuel companies are looking for an end product and they're manufacturing demand for stuff that doesn't exist right now and is trying to convince us as a society that this is what I need. So let's talk about like food packaging, for example. They're essentially trying to speak to companies that make food products and convince them that, you know, it's a safety issue, that their product needs to be hermetically sealed in plastic so it can survive like a nuclear war. I don't know. Like the shelf life of food products is going up into the multiples of years when that food product is going to be eaten in 10 to 30 days, for example. It's trying to create a fear-based market on sanitation, which is asking companies to adopt much more plastic into their packaging by preying on their fears of contamination. And it's all fear-based. And it's just another attempt of these companies. They see, well, there's a lot of natural gas under the shale formation. We need to pull it up and we need to make something out of it because we make money when we do that. And so they are trying to pivot away from, as I said before, fuels and energy because that's becoming electrified and they know it. They know that the time is up for how they traditionally did business, and they're just looking at for an end market for their feedstock, which plastics is the most promising right now. And where is it going? You know, when we're done with it, it's typically being exported to the poorest countries on Earth. And, you know, as countries get smart, they stop allowing plastic to be imported. But it's a race to the bottom. It's similar to sort of like sweatshops for clothing manufacturers in the 80s and 90s. The same thing is happening with plastic exports because there is no market for this. Even if you, as a consumer, are diligently and responsibly putting stuff into your recycle bin, it's very rare that it's actually being recycled because there is no market. And in many cases, in the worst possible end-of-life scenario, it's being exported to poor countries that are burning it for fuel.
That's really interesting. Can you explain more about the plastics market crash and how that has affected developing countries?
Free enterprise market-based capitalism is based on the laws of supply and demand. When you have an endless supply, the demand goes way down. And that's the problem with plastics. They flooded the marketplace. They created a tremendous amount of waste. And the dynamics of this industry are such that it is still cheaper to produce virgin material than it is to recycling it. So the industry is propping up recycling as a solution to the plastic pollution crisis, full well knowing that it wasn't going to solve the problem. And frankly, I think we need to be suspicious of that in the first place, because if you're an industry who makes your money selling raw virgin plastic, why would you promote recycling as a solution if that's going to cut into your bottom line? That is literally shooting yourself in the foot. So they full well knew that this wasn't going to cut into their bottom line, but it was giving them an out for taking responsibility for the impact that the product was having on Earth. And let's remember that when you go to the store and you buy a product, it's wrapped in plastic. The company that made that product does not care if they get that plastic back. It has that little value that it's meant to be thrown away. I don't think people really Think about that.
So with this huge plastics build out, is there anything that we can do as consumers to stop it? Do we just stop using plastics altogether?
You know, there's a role for individual action and being mindful and conscious of what products we consume and what their real, you know, impacts are on both people and planet. But I think there's only a limit to how much you can do personally. Like, you can never use plastic again for the rest of your life, and you're not going to change society. And I think, like, sometimes I have issue with this because people feel individually powerless. And what they don't recognize is that feeling of powerless has been engineered systemically by an industry to keep you from acting and make you feel as though it's hopeless and you can't do anything. When really, you know, and I've seen it with my friends and colleagues, present company included, people organizing together and stopping major aspects of the plastics build out, disallowing certain kind of packaging, eliminating single use plastics in various policy and legislation. I think if someone were to ask me what you can do, I would say stop asking yourself what you can do and start asking yourself what we can do, because that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a village, and it's going to take more people working together to stop these industries from wreaking havoc in their communities.
Is there any way for us to hold these companies accountable for the plastic waste that they're creating or for the chemicals and the pollutants they're putting into our environment during the manufacturing process?
Certainly. I mean, litigation is having a lot of success with regard to toxics exposure. I'm really heartened by the kids lawsuit in Montana. You know, so I think more and more the jig is up and people are recognizing that, you know, this industry is running amok. And yeah, I also kind of want to reframe that question. Like, if we don't hold these companies accountable, the world we're going to inherit is not going to be a place we want to live. It's not going to be a place where we can hunt and fish. It's not going to be a place where our kids are going to play outside or go on a camping trip and see a bear. It's like, it has the ability to totally destroy the natural world in a way that I think is incomprehensible to most people. And it's happening very slowly. It's like the most gradual atomic bomb that's ever gone off.
So is there anything that gives you hope that we may be able to start to solve this problem?
Oh, I think we already have started to solve this problem. And I'm incredibly hopeful, which I think, you know, if you listen to this thus far, you're probably worried for yourself and you're worried for your kids. But let me, like, give you a real dose of reality here. You know, I watched the movie Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo talking about a chemical plant in West Virginia. And this isn't that long ago. There was no academic or scientific understanding of the effects of this chemical. It's called PFAS. I won't go into it, but it's incredibly dangerous for people and incredibly dangerous for livestock. But even when, you know, the lawyers for DuPont who manufactured this chemical, they had no idea what it was doing to the environment. Like, that sort of information gap is, we don't know about the long chronic exposure stuff yet, but we now have several years of data on how dangerous any petrochemical is to people and planet. And so we're now at least, like, know what we're dealing with, which is a quantum leap in understanding. So we're no longer, like, just passively being polluted. We know we're being polluted. The other thing that gives me hope is there are a ton of people on the ground with this knowledge who are organizing and winning. I'll give you one piece of hope. We're working on a story right now, both in the Ohio River Valley region and the Gulf Coast, primarily Louisiana. There was a plastics plant much bigger than the Beaver Cracker that was proposed in St. James Parish, Louisiana, which is right along the Mississippi River, predominantly Black community. And this is also where the most brutal of enslavement in U.S. history happened, on Plantation Row on the Mississippi Delta. And when slaves died on the sugarcane plantations, they knew that they couldn't mark their graves with anything that was going to stand the test of time. Because all they had access to was like wood. Like, you make a wood cross, but that is going to rot and fall apart. So they planted these live oak trees to sort of future-proof where their descendants would be able to find them. Fast forward to now, and you have descendants of the enslaved in Louisiana finding sacred burial grounds in places where multi-billion dollar projects by multinational corporations are proposed, and they're stopping them by showing where these sacred burial grounds are. And in the United States, you cannot build on a sacred burial ground. It is the sophistication and creativity of advocates that are stopping multi-billion dollar corporations from building these polluting plants. And these are people with almost no resources. And when we're talking like a David and Goliath story, like, Goliath is 1,000 feet tall and David is 1 millimeter tall in this scenario. And they're still winning and they're still beating it. So, yeah, I'm super hopeful because we're getting, you know, more creative as a movement on how to stop these things. And a lot of progress is made. I still think we have some dark times ahead, but I think eventually, as Dr. King said, you know, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And I think it is. It's bending towards justice.
That leads into my next question. What are the biggest lessons that you have learned in your research and advocacy?
What I'm super mindful of with having a career in advocacy is what people don't recognize is it's contingent on community and community resilience and community power, which is also what we're all looking for from a human connection standpoint. Capitalism, fossil fuels, plastic products, they all make us say, what can I do by myself? What pushing back on that system says is, what can we do? So it actually improves your life to get involved from a happiness standpoint, satisfaction standpoint. Yeah, we have a lot, you know, as advocates, we're going to have a lot of like angst about the world and where it's going and, you know, the dangers of these massive industries. But also, we're meeting very strong and inspiring people. We're learning new skills from these people. We're sharing those skills. And so, like, I guess what my biggest takeaway from being a career activist at this point is that it's fun and personally satisfying beyond necessary for human civilization. It actually is, it can fill a lot of holes that I think people have in life, because modern culture is not really inviting us in to work together, and pushing back on that is.
So let's talk about your role as a filmmaker. Can you tell us about your new film, Goliath is Wobbling?
We're working on a new documentary that is sort of a comparative experience of the Ohio River Valley and the Gulf Coast, where these are the biggest chemical corridors in the United States. And these are very different sort of cultures that it affects. In the South, you're primarily talking about the descendants of the enslaved, so primarily people of color communities, indigenous, Latinx, Latino, and, you know, African Black as well. And then in the Ohio River Valley, this is sort of the legacy of boom and bust cycles from coal, timber, coal, steel, and this is largely white rural folks. And what we recognized is these two cultures are pretty different politically. They're not actually that different from a human value standpoint. And, you know, frankly, I would say the differences between these cultures are far fewer than the similarities in my opinion, you know, the powers that be are stoking a culture war to stave off a class war. And this is the story of America, as I see it now, is communities all over are standing up to push back against the fossil fuel industry for so many reasons, most of which we've enumerated thus far. And they're actually succeeding. So in this David and Goliath fight, Goliath is wobbling. He's on the ropes and he hasn't fallen yet. But to think that like a consortium of eight black grandmas in Louisiana stopped a multi-billion dollar plastics plant from being built. Eight grandmas did this. So that gives me hope that we can topple Goliath. And so our film is really looking at the people on the front lines of the extraction and refining and connecting their lived experience to the system of plastics and petrochemicals that we use every day in commerce. So that as a general public member, when you're thinking about the dangers of these materials, you're not only thinking of what's it going to do to a whale, a dolphin, or a sea turtle, you understand that it's doing something to your fellow human even before you used it. So it's not that we can consume and dispose of plastic safely. It's that plastic inherently kills the second it comes out of the ground. And our film is really going to illuminate that connection. Goliath is Wobbling is looking to be out in the first part of 2025. And there'll be a massive grassroots screening throughout the movement. And everybody will have access to it. Clean Air Council will have a copy. And they can show all their members as well. So keep an eye out, but early 2025 and maybe some grassroots screenings in the fall of 2024 before it's released at a festival.
Yeah, well, keep us in the loop. We'd love to host a screening.
Certainly will.
Thank you, Stair, for joining us today to talk about the issue of plastics, their connection to the oil and gas industry, and the waste that they create. To learn more about Stiv's work, please visit keepplasticfoundation.org. Watch The Story of Plastic on Prime Video and look out for his new film coming in early 2025, Goliath is Wobbling. Thank you to our listeners for tuning into On Air with Clean Air Council. To support our work, please consider becoming a member at cleanair.org/donate. That's cleanair.org/donate. You can also follow us on social media at Clean Air Council on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.